Thank you very much. So I would like to tell you about our experimental work on strontium fluoride molecules and on the deceleration of those molecules. So this is now about direct cooling methods to bring different molecules than KRB also to low temperatures. And the motivation for this is essentially that we'd like to do precision measurements. This will happen inevitably in combined fields, where I mean with combined, probably static, magnetic, static electric, AC electric, and an optical trapping field perhaps. So it's getting, at least from the experimentalist point of view, already pretty complicated at that point. So what I would like to talk about, first I'll introduce our motivation by giving a few examples of testing the standard model of physics. Because that's what these kind of measurements typically aim to do. Then I'll talk about how to use cold molecules to do that, and then introduce you to the experimental techniques that we use. So that's the main part, and try to show you how stark deceleration works and what recent developments in stark deceleration techniques have added to be able to decelerate a new group of molecules that are very interesting for precision measurements. And then, of course, I'll show the status of our experiment and then end with some open questions. So testing the standard model, I'm not going to talk that much about the standard model, but I guess you all know what the standard model is, right? It describes essentially all particles, the forces between them. We have the quarks, the forces, leptons, and there's of course the Higgs boson in the center, which we recently found, probably. Standard model is great and has been tested also to great accuracy, but it's not complete, I think. There are still some unsolved mysteries where perhaps, on the origin of mass, which is connected to the Higgs boson, that might be solved a little bit more now that has been identified. But still there are open questions like where is the antimatter that's supposed to be here. Here you see two people annihilating when they give a handshake. I guess that's illustrating a matter person and an antimatter person meeting, which doesn't happen. Those kind of existential questions are still unsolved. So there is dark matter. I guess people agree that it's that there is dark matter and dark energy, but what is it exactly, and how does it connect to all the everything that we know, and also the expansion of the universe, the speed at which that is happening, and can we explain the values of the physical constants, are actually the physical constants constant at all? Because nowadays the precision measurements are getting so precise that it becomes possible to test on a laboratory timescale the variation of constants like the alpha fine structure constant to great precision. So normally you might connect these kind of physics questions and attempt to address them with the Large Hadron Collider, for example, at CERN, where we probe using super high energy collisions for direct access to new particles showing up as resonances in certain collision processes. However, there's also this, so this is then called the energy frontier, moving to higher energies. There's also something called the precision frontier. I put there a picture of let's say, a normal sized optical table with some equipment on it, which is actually not being used for precision measurements. And this is just a setup that I developed during my PhD to do calcium atom trapping, but it shows the kind of colorful lasers and the size of an experiment that could be used to do precision measurements in the lab. And I put here now, so usually we would say precision measurement on the atomic scale. Molecular scale is not so much different, but it's a little bit more fitting for this workshop, right? So, and it's important to realize that the two different approaches are complementing each other. At least, of course, that's what we aim for. And for some parameters, one approach might be better, and it could also give access in a different way to essentially constraining the parameter space for standard model extension. So that's what you should think about when we're talking about testing the standard model, that people come up with all kind of theories to explain things that don't fit in the standard model right now. And as a group theory, should predict some values that we can then try to measure in the lab. That's what the precision measurements go for also. So I'll first start with a few examples of measurements on this precision frontier. And perhaps one of the most well-known experiments, which is also about parity violation, is the cesium experiment that has been done. Well, it took over 12 years to do the whole experiment, but it was published in 1997, the measurement of parity non-conservation and Annapol moment in cesium. So it was actually the first measurement of the Annapol moment, which is a kind of parity violating effect that arises. It's actually not beyond the standard model, this Annapol moment, that arises in the weak interactions between the nucleons. There was just observation of the parity non-conserving interaction strength between two levels that are normally forbidden. Now there is the need for theory calculations to get the amount of stark mixing, and initially in a paper of 1997 also, there was reported that you can get the weak charge out, which was actually 2.5 sigma away from the standard model prediction, which is of course exciting and reason to study this more. But then, I guess also after much of long, hard work, there was this work also with André Derevyanko, who could show that actually the measurement and the standard model prediction agree very well. So at least I can say from the experiment that this is really a state-of-the-art experiment that it seems hard to be able to improve upon. I'm not sure in how far that also goes for the theory, but I assume it's the same thing. It would be very hard to push that still further. Nonetheless, it's of course also tempting to make some remark about the way the theory and experiment converge, but I guess that's really not biased here. Although it's getting now, at least in experiments, also theory, I guess more and more common to do somehow a double blind evaluation of the results. But this is now getting good agreement, which is fine, so which also means actually there's nothing beyond the standard model so far in this experiment. Another example that you might be familiar with is the search for the electric dipole moment of the electron. So to go over the argumentation which is written on top, so an electron EDM would violate time reversal violation. And the standard model essentially rules out an electron EDM. So in this graph you see on the horizontal scale the size of a electric dipole moment, permanent electric dipole moment of the electron, and the standard model predicts it to be super tiny, 10 to the minus 39 or 40 electron centimeter. We cannot probe at that level. That's far away from the sensitivities that we have. However, if you would find a non-zero value of the electron EDM, it would directly prove that there are some physics which is not in the standard model, so beyond the standard model physics. And many of the alternative models, so this is what I remarked about before, about constraining the parameter space of alternative models to the standard model, do predict a larger electric dipole moment for the electron. Yeah?
Are there any limits on this from LHC and Davitron? Are they much, much worse?
Specifically on the electric dipole moment electron, I don't think so.
No.
So by pushing now in experiments, and so the experiments are kind of over here, you try to move this boundary to lower values. So even though you measure zero perhaps all the time, right, you find some limit and you say, okay, we searched very hard and we didn't find an electric dipole moment that was larger than this value. And this value is unlimited by, well, how good is your experiment? And at the moment, cold molecule experiments are the most sensitive way to do this, and I guess you'll hear more about this also during the conference, but just to summarize the point, in an experiment using ytterbium fluoride molecules, the group of at Heinz in London have recently put the most sensitive limit on the dipole moment of the electron, using a beam of ytterbium fluoride molecules. And this works so well because there's essentially an enhancement of an applied electric field inside the molecule. So the electron which is inside the molecule experiences super high electric field that you would normally never be able to apply to an electron, also because, well, any sizable electric field, the electron would just fly away. So the molecule is enhancing the field and thereby reducing the system, the sensitivity to external fields like magnetic background fields. I will not go over this experiment in detail because you could do an entire seminar on that. But in the end, what you do is cleverly reversing electric and magnetic field sizes, and you look for a sign that correlates with the direction of the electric field. That would give a small frequency shift if you had an electron EDM.
So was this then a tighter bound than the atom on the previous slide that you showed?
Yeah, this is now the best bound.
So where is it?
It's actually, it should be somewhere over here. So you have to, of course, when comparing this, you have to see what kind of, so this is a 90% confidence limit,
yeah.
10.5 times 10 minus 28, you could say 1 times 10 to minus 27, right? So it's over here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have the solid state experiments here as well?
No, not on this graph. No, where?
Oh, but what is the sensitivity now, like the best one?
And it's off the scale, right?
So. It's off the scale on the left side.
It's that horrible.
Yeah. Right. So, and this is being done using, well, what we could call this cold molecule because they're internally cold, very well controlled in a single quantum state, but still moving through the lab in a few hundred meters per second. So, what we're thinking about, is to do these kind of measurements, but then using trapped molecule.
Can you use actually buffer gas beam for this?
For this experiment, not yet. No.
Not for the experiment.
Yeah. Right. Another example is what I mentioned about the time variation of the constants. If we look at the ammonia molecule, which is depicted here, with the nitrogen in the center, it kind of flips back and forth in an umbrella motion, which is tunneling through the plane of the three hydrogens. That leads to an inversion splitting. And the size of this inversion splitting for ammonia is 22.6 gigahertz, but for deuterated ammonia, so ND3, is much smaller. It's 1.6 gigahertz, I believe. So what you can see from that already is that the tunneling frequency is very sensitive to the mass of the proton. So by measuring that frequency very accurately, you can look for a change of the proton to electron mass ratio, so mu. And in an experiment in Amsterdam, Rick Bethlehem and his group are setting up a molecular fountain to try to measure this. And this fountain, I'll get back to it later on, but it's essentially a molecular beam experiment where you shoot the ammonia molecules up, and then through a Stark decelerator you take out the longitudinal energy, and then what you would like to do is shoot them up and let them come down again twice through a microwave cavity, and then a Ramsey measurement, you would do a very precise frequency.
Do they also do laser cooling to confine it kind of transversely?
Laser cooling has not been shown to work yet for ammonia.
Will it be a problem? Like, with atoms you can do everything, but
right. So that's why this is a very challenging experiment, I might say. The transverse velocity is, of course, has to be small enough for the molecules to also come back again. There are tricks in phase space manipulation that you can do where you can trade off essentially the physical size of your package and the velocity of the molecule. So if you allow for packets to expand and then launch it upwards and down, you can have a very small transverse velocity. And then you need some clever focusing electrodes to be able to do that experiment. But so far, it's still work in progress. Okay, so from these examples, I'd like to summarize this. Well, molecules are interesting for precision measurements because compared to atoms, at least, you have many energy levels that are close together and depend differently on alpha or mu. They're of course very sensitive to electric fields, which is what polar molecules essentially bring, what atoms don't have. Now, to use cold molecules is promising because you get increased sensitivity and precision. So, of course, you need, this richness of states is nice, but not good for precision measurement. So you'd like to treat the molecule essentially as an atom in one single quantum state and have it all nicely defined. So cold molecules are good because you have low temperatures, low velocity, and in principle you already can get an enhanced interaction time. And then you could also see in the electron EDM measurement there is a relatively large region of controlled fields where the molecules fly through, could be half a meter or so, where you do the controlled measurements. Now the idea of using trapped cold molecules, you would be able to take even longer interaction times and then do a precision measurements. And can be an advantage that you don't have to control your fields over half a meter region, but just a, let's say, a cubic millimeter or so where your molecules are. It also brings some difficulties with it, and that's what we're currently looking into. So you could say that precision measurement with atoms is still, let's say, ahead, especially using optical clocks or ion clocks or so. But there are some enhancement factors in the molecules that can compensate for the precision measurement or the measurement in the precision that we currently have. So just to illustrate this idea of that you have actually a longer interaction time if you start with a cold sample, and it's relatively obvious. So in many of these cases, the measurement sensitivity scales with the square root of the number of particles, but linearly with the coherence time that you have. So that's important, and the interaction time should also be coherence time. But so if you compare just some region, 5 by 5 centimeter volume or so, where you want to do your experiment, if you have a beam flying through, you have something like 300 microseconds perhaps of time. If you have decelerated and trapped the molecules and then let them expand, so you switch off trapping field and then just do the measurement in the expansion, you could get 8 milliseconds, so it's already a pretty big increase. But if you can then also do laser cooling, for example, to reduce the temperature much further to below a millikelvin, then you really see that you can gain a factor of 1,000 in interaction time, even if you don't trap them but just let them expand compared to a beam experiment. Yeah.
Question about density. Do you have to keep the density low for precision measurements, or is that never an issue? The beams are always
So far, always in the experiments I've done, also for example using trapped OH molecules, we thought that the density was always so low that they would essentially not see each other. But now, from the experiments of John Yee on evaporative cooling of OH, it's apparent that actually they do see each other, because the densities are very similar to what we had before. So that's an interesting question and something we'll have to investigate. It could be that in the end, the kind of precision measurements we plan to do are first, you could say limited, or you could also say they are sensitive to interactions between the molecules. So the idea to use molecules is not new and goes back already a long time before I was born. These are just some examples where Sanders and Flambaum worked a lot on this, 1985, and also Dave DeMille and Kozlov and many people have proposed to use molecules to do parity violation, essentially. So the idea itself is not new, but what is new is the experimental control to be able to now bring these molecules to really low temperatures. So, and I would like to bring up this plot that I guess all of you know by heart, from a special issue from a few years ago, showing on this double, so it's twice the same plot, logarithm of the temperature versus logarithm of the density. Here are the techniques, and here is what you would like to do with the molecules. So you can separate the techniques into, let's say, indirect methods and direct methods, where direct methods you take the hot molecule, make it cold, and indirect, take cold atoms and make a cold molecule. Now for many of the things, you would like to be up here. And so that's also where potassium rubidium, for example, now is, or at least pretty close to it. However, you see that for precision measurements, a fundamental test, you don't need that low temperature, or you don't want that high density. So and the kind of techniques that we're talking about is then stark deceleration and alternative versions of it, buffer gas cooling, perhaps enhanced with a bit of laser cooling, sympathetic cooling, evaporative cooling, The question marks are slowly starting to fade away in the last few years, but still it's work in progress. So in principle what we're after is to do the precision experiment on the trapped sample of cold molecules in a single quantum state. So if we want to do this, well then, specifically to the example that we are currently working on, and that is the motivation to trap strontium fluoride, is to do a parity violation experiment. So this is the rotational level structure of strontium fluoride, and you see there are these doublets with opposite parity. Tuning an electric field, you can bring these states which are already close to each other. The energy scale here, the rotational constant is a quarter of a wave number. So it's about 15 gigahertz of spacing between these levels. Right, it's a half a wave number. You can tune them to degeneracy in a magnetic field, and if they're then really degenerate, then you get a super large enhancement, effective enhancement of the parity violating coupling between the two levels. And then the experimental trick is to get that parity violating coupling out of your measurement to do that. So this is then a zoom in on the magnetic field, and I've just drawn here some kind of avoided crossing illustrating that, well, we're interested in some kind of coupling. If there's a background electric field that will also couple these levels, you actually need an oscillating electric field to get a stark interference between the parity violating coupling strength and the induced coupling strength. And the stability needed, I say, so in the end the experiment would be you make molecules in this state, bring them up here, couple the states for some time, as long as possible, and then look how many molecules made it to this other state. Essentially, you would like to do this at very small distance away from this crossing, and that translating to a magnetic field stability where you would need to control the magnetic field and other systematic effects to that this spacing is about 1 kilohertz. So that's about how close you would like to be or need to be to pick up effects from the electroweak interaction in this system. Yeah, that's an interesting question. How large is that, and when at what temperatures and densities would that show up? I don't know the answer yet, but I guess it shouldn't be too hard to look at that. And of course in here, so we could try to measure something, but then there's still a large contribution for theory to work out what it really means that we measured. So in principle, theory input for us from the experimentalist point of view is, well, tell us what is the most sensitive atom and molecule, because not every molecule will have the same sensitivity to parity violating physics or an electron EDM or so. And of course, to translate what we measured in the lab to a parameter in the standard model. And for example, if you talk about parity violating coupling between these two states, there are different contributions. It's the Annapol moment, the spin-dependent weak interaction, which might be really interesting, but also the weak charge. So you need the theory of the atom or the molecule to be able to disentangle those, and you would also have to measure different systems actually. And then if you look beyond the standard model, so it could be that you get so precise that you can measure all this interesting standard model physics, but at some point you might hit something beyond the standard model. And there have been proposals, for example, that it could be in such an experiment that you get signs of a so-called dark Z boson coupling to the normal Z boson, that you would be able to detect dark matter using such an ultra-cold molecule. I don't know if it could be done, but it would be an extra motivation to try. I mean, these are kind of small-scale experiments. Why not? And of course, the electron EDM that I already talked about. So, what kind of molecules are good then for these kind of measurements? Well, usually you would need an open shell molecule because you want the electron to interact with the nucleus, and in principle, the heavy nucleus for a variety of enhancement factors. And this is the periodic table with let's say, combinations of these two red blocks we've looked into so far, and that looks really promising. So it's essentially alkaline earth with a fluorine or chlorine atom or so. There are many more combinations possible. But these groups, this group of molecules is interesting, and so here they are drawn. They are doublet sigma ground state molecules. Here are the other electronic levels. Of course, they vary if you change the composition of the molecule. But what's important for us, an experimental point of view, is that you have a very nice in the red electronic transition for strontium chloride, which means that you can use diode lasers, and then these kind of, well, might be small detail if it's 560 or 660, but this actually is very convenient in the lab. And they also put in now the Yo molecule, which is, of course, very interesting as well, which is essentially isoelectronic. So it works in the same way, even though there is now a doublet delta state below this doublet pi state, which might present an extra leak. But that's in the same kind of range. So these are interesting molecules. They have short electronic lifetimes. So this doublet pi state is short-lived. And that's something, for example, for laser cooling that you need to be able to scatter quite a few photons. There's a large Frank-Condon overlap, which means that if you excite this molecule, the strontium and the fluoride will not be vibrationally excited, which is very good for the decay, to prevent the decay to other vibrationally excited states.
So does it hold for all those molecules?
Well, more or less. So not all of these molecules have been completely analyzed, but at least for calcium fluoride, it seems very good. Ytterbium fluoride seems reasonable. Barium fluoride, probably. Yeah. Yeah. Electronic transitions are indivisible, which is good. They're paramagnetic because they're a doublet sigma state. They have this alternating parity and rotational structure, which is good for parity violating measurements. Rotational constants are small, depend on your perspective, I guess, but you can tune these to degeneracy, which is important for a parity violation measurement. And they're strongly polar also, which means, of course, you have the long-range anisotropic interaction, huge internal fields. And you could, well, in general, you can use electric fields to manipulate these, for example, stark deceleration. And you can make a beam out of those, which is also important. So this is all very good. But you cannot make them from laser-cooled atoms. So you need really the direct cooling methods then to, if you want to do something with these. So even though for some of the applications now I would say something like potassium rubidium is the system to go, for the precision measurements, very often that's actually not the case, unless you can find some transition in one of these molecules. That would be great. So we come back to this. Let's say, okay, now we really have to look into stark deceleration in some more detail. So here it is. I would say this is almost a reason to switch to experiment. So this is one of the latest stark decelerators in the lab at the Fritz Haber Institute in Berlin. I'll talk a bit about what stark decelerators are and what new developments now enable new groups of molecules to be decelerated. So it all looks so shiny because you put a high voltage on these electrodes, and that is to prevent the discharge. So I'll go over this relatively quickly, but still I guess it's important to say how it works. So stark deceleration works on the effect of the electric dipole moment in the electric field. If you imagine a dipole small dipole here in the electric field, it depends on the orientation, whether it will be attracted to the low field region or to the high field region. There will be a net force on this small dipole. And for example, for the NH molecule here in the metastable state, this JS2 rotational level splits up into various components. And some components of these are low field seeking, and they will stay that way. So it means that actually this molecule will lose kinetic energy as it flies into a region of higher electric fields. So that's what you would do in the lab. You take a molecule, let it fly into a range of high electric field, and it will just stop. If that energy is large enough. But you already see that this energy So this is in wave numbers. Perhaps you're not used to thinking in wave numbers. Wave number is 30 gigahertz. I'll give some more examples of this later. And the kind of electric field strength that you can do in the lab without too many problems is 100 kilovolt per centimeter. So that you can still do. So then the principle of a stark decelerator is usually you let the fly, this is the same thing. You start with a molecule. So you make, using electrodes, you make an array of high and low electric field regions. You shoot a molecule into this construction, and you have, for example, these two electrodes on a high voltage, large voltage difference. So a molecule flying into this region will start to lose kinetic energy. However, it's not enough to make the molecule stop, so it will roll off the other side and it will gain the energy again. So what you do is you switch every time that the molecule is almost at the top, you switch the fields and let it climb up that hill again. You need to switch fast enough, otherwise the molecule would still regain its energy. But you can do this fast enough, and then it depends on the how you time your machine when you switch these voltages, exactly what the final velocity will be. This was demonstrated in 1999 for the first time by Gerard Meyer and Rick Bedlam. And this is typically what a machine would look like. It's about 1 meter long, you have about 100 of these electrode pairs. You use large electric fields and you switch them quickly, and then you can take out the energy of, for example, OH. And this is an example of a time of flight measurement. So you start the experiment, you let the molecules fly through to a detection region, and at the detection region you measure when they arrive. So if you don't do anything, you would get something like this. Actually, I never measured that, so I just drawn kind of a Gauss curve here, which should be a Maxwell-Boltzmann or something. But anyway, if you switch on the fields, then you get this, well, distorted picture. This is not a Gauss anymore, and a fraction of the molecules arrive much later. And how late depends on how you program your decelerator. It could be that the final velocity is 100 meters per second if you start with 300, or it could be 30, or you could even stop. And these wiggles can actually be explained completely. So this is now a phase space view of that. So this is velocity versus distance in meter. And we take a snapshot of the package of molecules as it flies through the decelerator. And while these fields are being switched, and you see the same packet of molecules is being plotted, let's say 10 times or so, and you see that a fraction of the molecules is being pulled down to lower velocities until it really stops here. And some of the non-decelerated molecules are being modulated and wiggled back and forth, and that's why you see all this kind of structure here. So that's not noise, it's just really how the experiment works. This is not cooling, so that's important to realize. Stark decelerator is good for deceleration, but it's not the same as cooling, because we use all conservative forces. You cannot take energy out of the system, actually. So you just move part of it to a different velocity.
That's really great. But again, in terms of the bits, so let's say you take a fraction, right? I mean,
yeah.
So, I mean, could you look at this as maybe heating part of the ensemble, but cooling the other part of the ensemble, instead of, looking at the entire ensemble?
Well, it's difficult to talk about the temperature anyway. So at this point, I guess you could still do it, because you have some kind of thermal equilibrium. If the molecules don't collide with each other in a significant way, there will be no thermalization, so it's in a way nonsense to talk about the temperature at all. The width of this packet is smaller, so you could say there is some kind of average temperature which is low, and of course you take a slice out. So the kind of temperatures, if you just select part of the phase space, the temperature describing only this is actually quite low. It can be a few hundred millikelvin or so.
What about the phase space density?
Yeah, the phase space density does not increase. So you just take a certain area here. I mean, this is now 2D phase space. You would look at the total 6D phase space distribution and then take some region there. You can bring that to a different velocity in the lab, but the phase space density doesn't increase. So this will not bring you any closer to Bose-Einstein condensation or so. You would need something in addition to do to the molecules to get to higher phase space densities. But you can use this already, and as Gerrit also showed, you can use these tunable packets of molecules for collision experiments, for example. So this is just a whole series of time of flight profiles where we set a different setting on the decelerator, and you can use essentially these small packets of molecules for a collision experiment. If the molecules are slow enough, you can let these molecules climb up a final potential hill and trap them, and they would stay at the same spot for a few seconds or so. A second at least is possible, so that can all be done. So then you would say, okay, if this works so great, just take strontium chloride and put it in and stop it, right? So why have we not done that yet? Okay, so there are a few difficult things about decelerating strontium chloride. And that can be appreciated if we look at these different star curves. So here I plotted for ammonia, OH, strontium chloride, and strontium oxide, because Caden asked me to, different the lowest rotational levels and how they split up in this in electric fields. So the electric field is all the time the same, 10 times 10 to the 6 volt per meter, which is 100 kilovolt per centimeter. And the vertical scale is also in every plot the same. It's 2.5 wave numbers. Yeah.
How can they both be? Are they both doublet sigma, the strontium fluoride and oxide?
This should be a singlet sigma. You're right. Okay. Yeah, that's my mistake. Yeah, yeah. I was actually also going to put the dipole moment of strontium oxide here, which was 9 debye or so. That's why it's different. And this one looks a little bit thicker because I also included a hyperfine structure there. But what you see is that ammonia and OH have this very steep low field seeking state that just keeps going up with higher electric fields. So you can use 100 kilovolts per centimeter and you will take out at least one wave number of energy from these molecules. For strontium fluoride, you cannot do that because the rotational levels are closer together, and these kind of start to mix and repel each other. So there's only a limited amount of energy, for example, in this state that you can take out. So the energy scale here is on all plots 2.5 wave numbers, which is 75 gigahertz, which is about an OH molecule with 60 meter per second. So that's kind of... This looks like a lot, right? But still, yeah.
Very stupid question. So it looks like, especially the strontium fluoride would be somehow an ideal high field seeker.
Yeah, yeah.
So you should be able to do that with a Stark decelerator as well, right?
Well, it has been demonstrated that you can decelerate molecules in a high field seeking state, but only to a very limited amount. So there's a technique which is called essentially dynamic focusing. You have a series of lenses defocusing and focusing and defocusing and focusing, and it should be stable, and it probably is stable, but it's so difficult to get these electrodes stable. Yeah. So essentially the what we call the acceptance of a alternate gradient decelerator, which is what it is, becomes so small that it essentially doesn't work. So a few labs have tried, and they also accomplished something. They could show that it works in principle, but in practice, nobody's doing that anymore.
What is acceptance?
The acceptance, that is the phase space acceptance. So it's essentially the size of the packet and the velocity transversely and longitudinally that you can accept into the decelerator and that you can bring to standstill. We will focus on this rotational state of strontium chloride. It's only 0.16 wave number, which corresponds to 6 meters per second of strontium fluoride. So that's a tiny amount of energy that you can at most take out of strontium fluoride. And even worse, you can have your high electric fields because you nicely polished your electrodes, but actually it will make it only worse because at some point at the higher fields the molecules will be attracted to the electrodes and crash.
Why don't you use the excited states where maybe you have a little bit more?
Yeah, right. Okay, so this is another interesting curve where you can go, of course, you can take more. You can take half a wave number out. Then it depends how much, let's say, if you can really make these kind of fields in the lab and if that's possible. By the way, strontium oxide looks better than strontium fluoride, but it's it's harder to make. And it's of course also a thing with sigma, so that's not so interesting for parity violation, for example. So and the second problem is instability. So even in these low field seeking states, for example for OH, a standard decelerator cannot be made as long as you want it to. So if you would like to build a 5 meter long decelerator to very gently take the energy out of the OH molecule, actually at low velocities, and that's what you see here. So here you see, I'm not even sure what molecule this could be, OH, or I think it's OH. In different carrier gases, you see you start at some velocity, you bring them down, and then the signal intensity from a certain point on starts to drop sharply. And that's when the velocity gets about 150 meters per second in this specific mode of operating of the Stark decelerator. And it is the molecule spent too much time essentially being transversely focused. So you have something called transverse overfocusing, and they will crash also against the electrodes. So even you could say, okay, well, I will just ramp the voltage down, use only this part, use a very long Stark decelerator, but it still doesn't work because it's unstable. If you do it quickly enough, you can still get away with it, and so we've also trapped away, so it works, but you cannot do it very gently and slowly, you would lose them all. So the solution then is something which we call a ring decelerator. So and there's quite a bit of information on this slide. So the big picture you see, the red dots, sorry, the blue dots are rings. So here I have drawn also, you perhaps see the rings, right? So we make a whole series of rings, that's why we call it a ring decelerator, and we apply a different voltage on each of those, at least in a periodicity of 8. So the first and the ninth electrode, they're on the same potential, and then the second and the tenth and the third and the 11th are on the same potential. Actually, it's kind of like a cosine. You distribute the voltages over these different rings. And if you do that, then you get inside these tube of rings, you get electric field minima. So those are these regions now. So it's a contour plot of the electric field strength. So this is in kilovolt per centimeter. So of course the highest fields are in between the rings, but also on axis through this tube you get electric field minima. So those are traps for molecules in the low field seeking state. And so up there you see essentially for the nth electrode you see how the voltage is a function of time also. So if you now start oscillating the voltage in time, what you will get is that these electric field minima are actually moving through this tube of rings. So, and what we then do in the experiment is make sure that this speed is exactly the same as the initial velocity of a molecular beam that you shoot into these tube of rings. So you shoot the molecules and you make sure that you switch them on exactly now, and then they travel along and it's like a conveyor belt for the molecules. And then by changing the frequency of the oscillation on the rings, you can adjust the velocity of these moving traps. And in that way you do a frequency sweep from about 30 kilohertz down to DC, and the moving traps will be stopped. So that's the principle, and it has been developed more or less in 2010. The first experiment was done on metastable CO. They could not stop the CO because the ring decelerator was half a meter long and it did not do enough. And later it also was shown actually that you can decelerate ytterbium fluoride a bit, from 300 meter to 276 meter per second using the same decelerator. So essentially what we're doing is building a much longer version of this. Well,
So the molecules come in at a certain speed, and then the moving traps initially at the same speed, and then you slowly break.
Yeah, right. It's like if you catch something in real life, for example, an American football was thrown to you by the quarterback, and you try to catch it, then you also do this gentle deceleration, right? You cannot stop them all at once. So, but you need to move with the ball a bit and then catch it.
But still, there's a friction involved in your
example,
right? But here, where is the friction?
There's no friction, right? So friction is not the decelerating thing. So what you have actually, so the question might be, how fast can you now decelerate these molecules? Because if you just if you stop.
So where does the kinetic energy go? In the field.
In the field. Yeah. 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 So what you do in practice is then, of course, make sure that you have a deceleration of this effectively. So you go in the frame of the moving molecule and you apply a deceleration. And what this deceleration will do is essentially tilt the force on the molecule. So it's actually the gradient of this trap that determines, together with the mass and the Stark shift, how fast you can decelerate the molecules.
And I noticed that the black ones are the minima, right? The darker colors.
Yeah, yeah.
So I see that they like to go to either to the top or the bottom, right? Because that seems to be the minimum.
You mean this wiggling between whether it's in between the rings or?
But there seems to be a settle point developing or something.
Here, at some point. Here.
Yeah, there. There.
Yeah, that's true.
That's where they leave? Or that's the weak part of the trap?
Well, the weakest part, so I guess you should look at the kind of circle, which is a sphere, right? Which still folds around the trap completely, no matter where it is. And that's the weakest part. So essentially, you cannot use the fields of 30 kilovolts per centimeter here. It actually, the limiting field will be something more like here, in this image. Perhaps 15 or 20 kilovolt per centimeter, which is also the reason that for strontium fluoride, actually this curve is pretty good, because we go up to fields of, so depending on the high voltage amplifiers that we have, you can rather easily get this kind of fields for the edge of the moving minimum.
Question, how the molecules put into these again, are you ablating them from somewhere? Are you taking a beam and you're putting into this thing?
Right, we're taking a supersonic beam. I'll show how we do that.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. This I will skip. It essentially shows that the ring decelerator is more stable than a non-ring decelerator.
Sorry, I'm confused about something trivial. Can you go back a couple of slides?
How many?
Yeah, one more. Oh,
one more.
Yeah, this is one. Yeah. That's volts per. Oh, that's times 10 to the 6. Good. Okay.
Yeah. So this is. Yeah. I had a hard time getting these units out to kilovolts per centimeter. So I thought it's volt per meter. 100 kilovolt per centimeter. Okay, so the overview of the experiment looks then like this. You take some kind of supersonic beam, and from a strontium fluoride target, it's a powder we press, make a pill, shoot at it with a laser, and then you create a small plume of all kind of different molecules, among which strontium fluoride. And this strontium fluoride gets carried along in this expansion of the carrier gas and gets cooled internally and goes through the skimmer and then into the decelerator, which is a long series of these rings. And there you have the moving fields. So the whole experiment as we foresee it is like this. You do laser ablation, short laser pulse, 10 nanoseconds or so, which creates a very hot plasma, right? Could be 1,000 Kelvin or so, and many molecules. Then they go into supersonic expansion, which is kind of 100 microseconds, and which cools them down rotationally to about 3 Kelvin or so rotational temperature, which means that still a few rotational states are populated, but perhaps a quarter or so could be in the rotational state that we want to. We could have 1 million molecules going through the skimmer. That's the ytterbium fluoride kind of number being quoted, where we'd like to set that as a goal. Could be a little bit lower, but let's say we get that. Then we do the Stark deceleration, which takes a few tens of milliseconds, which has an efficiency of about 1%, so about 10 to the 4 molecules are being trapped at the end of the deceleration process. Then we do a bit of laser cooling, which doesn't have to take a very long time, because more or less most of the energy is already out of these molecules. So you cycle a few, where a few is, let's say, a few thousand photons, to bring the temperature down by about a factor of 1,000 to something like 150 microkelvin, where it's cold enough to be able to do an optical trap and then actually do the precision measurement, which is still in time quite a few years away from us, to be honest. Yeah.
This 150 millikelvin after the deceleration is the translational temperature?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But it's still 3 Kelvin in terms of the relativity.
No, because well, the star shift is different for the different rotational states, and essentially what you quite often get is a rather pure sample, which is also something Gerrit mentioned. Even though rotational state selectivity is not perfect, in many cases you just get one rotational state.
Is the laser cooling full 3D? Is it not a molasses type thing?
I think 1D cooling would be enough to get them 3D cold if they are being mixed. So this is also more or less the point where we, I mean, so this I know exactly how it will do, and it's a question of building it. Here we get into more unknown territory, but from what we think now, it should be feasible to do it like that. Okay. So a bit about this laser cooling. The main work has been done by Dave DeMille and also by Jun Yi. We're just setting up also the lasers to be able to do this with strontium fluoride. So it works on strontium fluoride, and here you see different vibrational levels in the ground and excited state because this Frank Condon overlap is so good, so only one in every 50 photons will decay to the V is 1. Then you put a laser there to pump those back. If you put those back, then the leaks are getting rather small. So actually, if you only have to take a little bit of energy out, like we would have to scatter about 3,000 photons, that's probably enough to just have these two repumpers. Well, that's only electronic structure. You might wonder, okay, how about, sorry, that's vibrational structure. How about rotational and hyperfine structure? Hyperfine structure, yes, there is hyperfine structure from the fluorine. It leads to an almost regular pattern of lines that you can quite easily match using an electro-optical modulator to create sidebands to a laser. So even though you need 4 different frequencies here, you can use one laser to make those. And rotational, it's rotationally closed because of parity and delta J selection rules. So you go from a minus parity ground state to a plus parity excited state. The next minus parity is actually forbidden by delta J because that would be larger than 1. So that's why it can stay rotationally closed also. Right, and then the main point is we take most of the energy already out in the decelerator and then do a bit of this to in an efficient way, so to say.
How many molecules do you expect to have by the time you reach this stage?
So the laser cooling itself actually doesn't need to lose any molecules. So we still expect to have 10 to the 4 molecules. And it's important perhaps to say that now this laser cooling is a dissipative step. And the fact that you have a dissipative step in the whole deceleration process also opens the way to what kind of reloading mechanisms or let's say getting a higher density here. So it's not, I will not exclude that we will be able to do something like that later on.
So you're saying the laser cooling can get you to 150 microkelvin, but I think in June's, and I think in DeMille's experiments, they don't get so cold. So
no, but so far the experiments they have done, if I'm correct, are also still limited by the interaction time. So the experiments have shown compression of the velocity, and also the effect of the magnetic field. So you could say it's a magneto-optical forces, but the molecules are not yet trapped. They move rather slow at 150 meters per second from a buffer gas source, but the number of photons scattered is not yet large enough to go down to these temperatures. This is essentially the recoil temperature that you would expect.
What's the technical difference? I mean, what would they have to do in those experiments to get this cold? They have to do
stop the longitudinal motion.
Right.
So or make a super long interaction zone.
And can they do that by just sort of doing the same thing somehow in the longitudinal directions, or do you really have to do something?
So a little bit of longitudinal cooling has also been shown, I guess. So I also don't... I think it will be able to make strontium fluoride come to a standstill using only optical forces or magneto-optical forces. Question is how many molecules you will have, how will you keep them there, how large is the volume, and then you should also keep in mind the decelerator itself is actually a rather general thing that we can put any molecule in that we want to. This last laser cooling step is of course selective only for a few molecules.
Okay.
in your time scale, like, it seems like star deceleration is the longest step, right?
So yeah.
Basically, then between different pulses of laser population, you could have maybe 100 milliseconds, right?
Yeah, the experiment runs at 10 hertz. Yeah.
Accumulate. So I guess you would ultimately expect maybe 10 to the fifth. Right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, if you would be able to do reloading and you have a traveling time of 1 second, then you would get that, something like that. Yeah. Okay, so far our plans. Now, where are we actually in building all this? So this is still actually a computer render, but it shows you how we make these rings and how we apply the high voltages. So we there are 8 rods that all have kind of tennis racket shaped electrodes connected to them, many. They look like this. So this is a 0.6 millimeter wire that we bend into this shape. It's a 4 millimeter hole. We try to make this as circular as possible, but of course, because they're also from a different angle, actually deviation from perfect circle is not such a big deal. And if we put 336 of those rings, we get a decelerator of a length of 0.5 meter. And that's what we built. So we have one of those here. This is the first ring decelerator we built. It's 0.5 meter long, many of these rings. And the first one we actually took to Amsterdam to put on top of the ammonia fountain. So the ammonia fountain that I talked about before to measure variation of mu, we tried to improve that fountain by putting a ring decelerator on top of the already existing normal Stark decelerator. So we have actually, we call this picture where the two worlds meet, right? I mean, it's here, the traditional Stark decelerator, then a little bit of free flight time. We'd like to get this shorter, but it's also for safety of high voltage discharges, and so you don't want to be too close. So the molecules have to jump, essentially, and then they're in this new moving trap. And inside the moving trap, we were able to trap the molecules. So that's the first time that we were able to really, in this moving trap, bring them to a standstill and keep them there. Well, then, of course, they're inside this tube of rings. So in order to detect them, you need to bring them out again. And actually, ammonia is being detected in a resonance ionization scheme. So you cannot detect them inside this ring, but you just pull them out again, and you can show that they stayed for 50 milliseconds or so inside that ring.
So what is the advantage to have both a traditional Stark decelerator?
Yeah. You might wonder now why you would do something like that. Like Misha already mentioned, for the fountain, it's critical that you have a very small transverse velocity, because otherwise they will come back, but they will be spread out over such a large region that you won't see them. And we think that actually the ring decelerator is an important step in achieving that, because it has complete cylindrical symmetry. So you, with a device like this, it's perhaps not so clear, but you have two electrodes like this, one pair, and then the next one is rotated by 90 degrees. So you always focus only in one transverse direction, and that makes it very difficult to get this nicely homogeneous. And by doing some clever tricks, by scaling the size of the rings and doing something in the end, should be able to get the fountain working also.
I am a little bit confused, because you stressed earlier on that you said the Stark deceleration is not a cooling device, right?
Yeah.
And now you say you put it on top there because you want to cool it.
No, well, it's still the same kind of phase space manipulation tricks that I mentioned before. You would let the gas expand, so at the cost of spatial dimensions of your trap sample, you would lose in transverse velocity. I mean, in using such a decelerator in a very homogeneous way.
Then you pay for this by losing atoms, is that?
Well, you lose. In principle, you don't lose any molecules. You just make your whole thing pretty large. So you have a small beam, then you blow that up and let it go up and come down again, and then you focus it again to a small region. So you trade. It's so if you think about phase space, you essentially let the packet rotate all the way until. Well, let's say in phase space, if it's vertical, almost you have a large spread in position, small spread air velocity. If you let it rotate all the way, then you have a very small, then all the molecules are at the same position, but you have a large velocity spread. So you can make that trade-off. And that's what you do in the steps here before you launch them up.
Well, that's something very stupid, but well, the idea of the fountain is to stop molecules before they start falling back, right?
Well, gravity does that.
Well, yeah, probably.
You will not bounce them back with a mirror or something. It would just be slow enough so that they...
So when the gravity stops them, will they be also transversely stopped, or they will still be moving?
They will still have transfer. I mean, gravity works only one direction.
How can it possibly work? I mean, if they are not stopped transversely, then...
Well, they will still have... So let's say it takes some time to launch them up and have them go down again. You just need to make sure that the transverse velocity is so small that the translation in position is small enough for you to be able to recapture at least a significant fraction of the molecules. But I know that Rick Betlem will be coming to the conference, and he'll certainly be able to give more details, perhaps, than I cannot, but this is the basis.
But it's basically like a cesium fountain clock, yeah. You know, where you toss a ball of cesium up and back down.
Right, for atoms it works as...
So the question, this is going in free space, like up a meter or so in free space?
Yes.
So once it exits the end of this little decelerator, it just is totally in no fields around.
Well, it could be that, so I actually don't know if you need to keep... I mean, you can compare, for example, to the ytterbium fluoride electron EDM measurement, where you just have a long interaction zone. You could have controlled fields there. I mean, you could also think about the ytterbium fluoride experiment in a fountain.
So one question for a polar molecule in a fountain, will the black body radiation shifts be any kind of a problem for you?
The black body radiation shifts, I don't...
Well, they're issuing atomic clocks.
Yeah, I don't think you would see the shifts because it's...
The problem actually is actually the population redistribution.
Yeah, the black body...
In the atoms, but in molecules, that will be a problem.
It's a... Just the radiation of the machine itself is exciting rotations in the molecule.
Right.
But, do you know what the lifetime for that typically is in strontium fluoride? No H, it's like water, but just a few seconds, right?
Right, for strontium fluoride, it would be even longer. So for some molecules, is it the vibrational excitation? For others, it's the rotational.
Time is like going to be second or less, right? I mean,
Perhaps a little bit less, but you're right.
But there won't be much population distribution over the time of the.
So it's actually an interesting question: if you compare a fountain versus an experiment in a trapped environment, which one is better?
Yeah.
But that really goes about systematic control of all the properties. What is easier, to get the molecules to do this kind of jump, or to confine them and go to magic conditions where effectively you get rid of the trapping field?
What fraction of the packet do you catch with the ring decelerator?
Oh, here we actually catch all. So the acceptance of the ring decelerator for ammonia is larger than the packet that comes out of the decelerator. Because they're already pre-decelerated, so they go 100 meters per second here, and then kind of you do a pre-selection of these molecules by the first decelerator, and then in the second one you gently bring them to standstill.
So what is the physical distance between the two?
Well, this is 4 millimeters, so this is 3 centimeters or so.
I would like to return to Suzanne's question. Actually, why don't they use the ring decelerator from bottom all the way up?
Well, this is the progress of technology, I guess. When this whole experiment was being designed, there was no such thing as a ring decelerator. So it's just that last year we've been able to build one, and in 2010, like I mentioned, the first one had been built, and I guess from that point on also Amsterdam group started to think about that.
So did you find out which one was the better one, or did you maybe already answer which of the two designs is better?
Well, it depends what you want to do. If you want to... So electronics is very complicated for such a... these oscillating high voltages and a sweep from high frequency down to DC, that is something that is very difficult. And we have high voltage amplifiers that can do this. The original 2010 experiment in Berlin was done using transformers, which can operate over a certain frequency range but cannot go down to DC. So there's technical issues which makes it a little bit hard to compare, but in principle ring decelerator is superior, I would say.
So what is the, what frequencies do I need to think of? That
30 kilohertz is the, yeah. Well, it depends on the size of your rings. If you want to get higher fields, then you can make smaller rings, but the frequency goes up, and for the electronics, it's still kind of the same problem.
Yeah. So, is it in philosophy a little bit like this this microchip where you also...
Yeah, it's in a way a scaled-up version of the of the chip deceleration experiments that have been done in Berlin, where you also take a series of bars on the surface and apply the same kind of potentials, and then hoovering above the surface, you get a series of tubes that move at the velocity, which is the same principle of this. So I guess that's also how it came about. Ah. If you think of the ring decelerator as a curled up version of the chip decelerator, but then just a factor of 1,000 or so smaller, that's what it is. So, okay, that's what we've done, and then we built another one, which looks surprisingly similar to the first one we built. but we need also more of these. So then, actually, we have a support system where we put two of these modules on one rod, but actually two is still not enough, so we have kind of, so these are computer images, right? But we're, so this is in principle a large flange of a vacuum chamber where there's a kind of a tube in between, but I made that transparent so you can see the decelerator. And in the end, this is what our experiment should look like. So now we have 10 of these modules for a total length of 5 meters. Well, you can just multiply all the numbers. Well, the number of ring electrodes is 10 times that of a single unit. The other numbers I already mentioned, and so we now have a small factory to make these kind of decelerators.
Do you a sort of a computer simulation to see actually what you're going to achieve before you actually make?
No, we just go. No. No, we can simulate the entire experiment in the computer. Okay. Yeah, that's of course. Worthwhile to work.
Violation?
Sorry?
So do you find parity violation?
Well, I kind of calculate up to the point where we have the molecules trapped, and for the rest I'm talking to everybody in the audience.
So this is all your small CERN machine.
It's still tabletop physics, but the table got a little bit larger. Yeah. So, right, so... this might seem like a lot of effort to just stop strontium fluoride, and of course it is, and we've been building now for 3 years, but it's important to realize that this is a general tool to decelerate a whole new class of molecules. It's not just strontium fluoride, but many others could be put in.
So that this is in principle like that, it makes complete sense, but can you actually, now let's say you do strontium fluoride and in a few years you figure, okay, strontium fluoride doesn't teach you anything anymore.
Yeah.
Can you use exactly that same machines for other molecules, or would you have, with the same design but other specifications, would you have to buy?
So the easiest to change is to another molecule that is being produced in a similar way, like also with laser ablation, because then the source is really just a question of changing, putting a different pill in, then we make a different molecule. The detection part is different for each molecule.
Of course, yeah.
So we'd ideally take another molecule that has kind of diode laser transitions. And for a diode laser, well, we're in an atomic physics lab surrounding also, so we can build a new diode laser in a week or so. And then we have, and they're also cheap. So that's really no limitation. For some cases, you would like to have something more flexible, but in principle, that switch is not so hard. So we also make it modular, so this is actually the place where the molecules are created. We can just put a different source on and shoot that into the machine. Of course, if I say a week, in practice it will always be a month and so on, but it's not impossible.
Nothing.
I mean, look, the price of LHC is about $6 billion, right?
Yeah.
This is about what? This is $1 million maybe, right?
So well, $1 million, right.
Yeah.
I think if you get to the price to LHC, I think you're not going to build it.
No, but to address the same kind of physics question, it's a cheap experiment.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, they use the same protons, in fact, right? So
sorry, they use
they the same protons, so you can use the same molecules. Yeah.
Right.
Could you comment on the relative merits or differences between strontium fluoride and strontium oxide?
Well, strontium oxide is a completely different molecule in the sense that it's a singlet sigma. It has a larger dipole moment. So from what I know, it's very difficult to make. Otherwise, it would be a perfect molecule to put in this machine. Another molecule that I know can be made, and which is also interesting for an electron EDM, is lead fluoride, which we would also be able to stop.
I also would like to ask a question about different molecules.
Yeah.
It's a continuation, actually, of what we discussed near the beginning of your talk.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to study parity-violating transitions of these paramagnetic species. Why not? But lately, actually, your measurement may be disturbed by the electric dipole that we're
interested. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
However, you need to use a polar molecule because you want to decelerate it using the star deceleration technique. Why not take a homonuclear molecule that is also paramagnetic and use Zeeman deceleration instead and you complete the rate of this possible perturbation in your measurement?
Right.
As
Well, it's good that you point out that you can also do this using magnetic fields. So some species might be good for this.
The common nucleus are not going to work in terms of
parity
violation. It's just you have to have some internal electric field inside of the molecule. For common nuclear molecules, it's out of the question.
Okay. So you would never be able to observe the transition to the different parity states in the magnetic field.
I don't think so.
And actually still, you once you have done the deceleration, you don't need to have these electric fields present anymore. So if they're cold enough, you could load them into a dipole trap, like we plan to do, and then you could have a zero electric field background measurement using just a very strong magnetic field. You could also magnetically trap them then, if that happens to be advantageous.
Seems to me that you have two kind of limiting factors to the choice of your molecules, in addition to what molecules are actually good for your final end, namely doing the upper measurement. Namely, you also, as your plan is set up right now, you need both molecules that lend themselves very well for this stock deceleration, but also some that lend themselves for laser cooling, which I think is an even more limiting case. So given the fact that I think now the laser cooling, especially now that the first labs have shown that, is a good idea. But is there on the longer run any ideas what to replace the laser cooling with?
Well, it seems evaporative cooling might also work a bit in some cases. And in that sense, you could also put OH in here, and you would have because you can do the deceleration so gently, you would have a large amount of molecules to start with, which is good for evaporative cooling. And also, not for all applications, you might need to go to 150 microkelvin or so. Perhaps there's something completely different you could do with water molecules, let's say. So let's say for strontium fluoride to get a parity violation, or for ytterbium fluoride to get an electron EDM or so, you will need to have the combination of all the techniques that I show. And it's actually perhaps surprising that there's more than one molecule for which this whole combination of restrictions seems to work. But the deceleration itself is more general. Okay, I think I have not too much more. So status of the experiment. We have the molecular beam. It works. We have four modules of half a meter each ready. So four plus one, actually, minus the one. So we have five built now. Alignment procedure works, so that's important if you want to align a few thousand small rings on one line. Electronics, so here you see actually one of the high voltage amplifiers being kind of moved on top of the machine. That's Joost van den Berg, a PhD student. We have the detection lasers that are also the same that are used for laser cooling, also set up. And in a first measurement that we did not so long before I came here, we used the first module in a configuration where you just put an alternating voltage on the rings, and then essentially you get a repelling wall from this tube of rings, and the molecules can be guided through. So you don't do anything on the longitudinal velocity, but transversely they're focused. And we just see that if you put the voltage on, that we get more molecules, which is not a very surprising thing. And we could also simulate this in a computer, and we know that it works, but it's important experimental achievement for us because we know everything's aligned, the laser works, the source works, many of the things work, so now we hope it's a question of quickly putting more modules together. So I should point this out, this is a rotational spectrum, so we make an electronic transition from the ground state to the excited state via 0 to via 0, and then we see here different rotational states in the ground state. And this is actually, I think this is the one that we want to decelerate. Yeah.
Now, one question about detectability of molecules, and maybe kind of goes back to what we were talking about last week, but yeah. A molecule that laser cools will cycle many photons. So
right.
Could you comment on the detectability of molecules like strontium fluoride, say, as compared to atoms or other kinds of molecules?
Right. I think if you can show that you can cycle 1,000 photons, then typically you would be able to detect 1% of those, which would be 10, right? So it would mean that you would need a rather low background, but you're getting actually pretty close to single molecule detection sensitivity. And if you can do more than 1,000, then it seems certainly feasible that you will be able to detect even a single strontium chloride molecule and do some experiments with that. So that's an important difference for us.
And what's the time scale for detection? These are still in a moving beam, right? So you're
So this experiment, they just fly through a beam, and that's another important difference. We have a continuous beam, and the molecules fly through, and we get a complete time of flight in one shot. So all these, so this is essentially, every point here is an integral of the entire beam as it moves through the molecular beam as it moves through the laser beam.
Yeah, some additional weak signals there. Other vibrational levels or other isotopes? What is this?
We think it's another isotope, but actually we did not put that completely into the simulation. But it was interesting to see that they go up, and they also go up with increasing electric field. So the spectroscopists...
For the vibrational population, if you really have this supersonic beam that you say I have only V equals zero, or...
Well, we know the rotational temperature is about 5 Kelvin, so that you can say from the kind of distribution.
Vibration is so low normally.
Right, so vibration should be a little bit higher, and then, I don't know, the vibrational...
Equals up to 3, probably,
2, 3. Equals up to 3, you think. We'd have to see. Could be. So, and in a way, in the other vibrational state, you have a complete copy of the same rotational state that we would be able, and probably also are, guiding and decelerating with the same efficiency.
For the particular pair of peaks you're talking about, you have almost equal intensity initially and a 2-to-1 ratio afterwards. Do you understand that?
Well, yeah, we do. So that is how I did not bring a picture of the hyperfine structure, but if you, it's essentially, yeah, let me go to, that's nice to show. So let me see if I can get to that picture quickly, where I show the different star curves. Where is that here? So you see, this is the rotational state that we were addressing, and a fraction of that is high field seeking, and a fraction of that is low field seeking. So the and there's a small splitting there. And now, if we go back to the laser cooling picture, here you see a zoom in. So there are two. So this is the omega doubling in the ground state. So there's a J1/2 and J3/2, and they're both a hyperfine split. And these essentially all connect to high field seeking state, and a fraction of those are low field seeking. So if we reduce the laser power, we actually see the hyperfine structure, and we see that we have 4 peaks, and only some of those get enhanced by the electric field. Yeah. Okay. Now I should do that a little bit quicker, because I was at my last slide. Boom. Okay, so concluding, I think that specific molecules are exciting to probe for new physics. For those molecules, quite a few we'll have to develop and further enhance these direct cooling methods. In our specific approach for strontium fluoride, we found that a combination of these three techniques will work. We look forward to actually do all this that we promise, but we will probably also be able to decelerate a range of new molecules. And then some open questions that also came up last week. At what temperatures actually and densities will we be limited or be influenced or be sensitive to interaction between the molecules, either because of the dipoles or something else, specific kind of interactions that we always thought were negligible but perhaps are not. That's interesting to see. Perhaps we're not studying parity violation at all, but dipole-dipole interactions, which could be interesting as well. And how to achieve magic conditions in a way for our specific experiment. So magic meaning that the trapping field itself is actually not disturbing the measurement too much. Of course, we know that we'd have to make the sample cold to reduce the influence of the trapping field, and it might be impossible to completely get it away, but the kind of stability that we need comes down to kilohertz separation between these two lines. And what do we have to do? Angles, frequencies of all the fields involved to do that as well as possible. That's also an issue we're currently interested in. And the last slide is just to show the people involved above the three PhD students and myself, and of course technical support, which is important. And Klaus Jungmann is a professor of the group of which I'm a part, and collaborating with the people in the bottom. So thank you.
I still wonder, comparing the new decelerator to the previous type, if you would use just to grab ammonia or OAs, what do you think about the densities you would get in a comparable experiment?
So the density is always given by the source, as the decelerator itself doesn't change the density.
Right, but what you can grab with one decelerator or the other may be different. So
right. And so
the number you showed was 10 to the power 4, but that was
for the number of molecules.
The number of molecules, okay.
Yeah, that's for strontium fluoride. So an important thing is that the easier you can do this deceleration, the less you lose.
Right.
And so I think actually that we would be able to have higher densities of OH or ammonia using this very gentle deceleration than the relatively rapid deceleration in 1 meter or so for trapped samples.
So maybe higher densities are
possible if you can, especially if you would be able to increase the fields a little bit. So we are limited now by the electronics to plus or minus 5 kilovolts on the rings. If we would be able to find another electronics company or person that can build us a set that does plus minus 10, we would be able to do a different rotational state, we would be able to decelerate faster with the same efficiency, or in the same length, we would be able to have perhaps 2 or 3 times the density. Well, the number of molecules, if the density is really there, yeah, right, it would still also go in the density because of the size of the trap stays the same.
So,
okay,
one more technical. So it's actually like a moving trap, right?
Yeah, so it's so really a moving trap.
Could you play like just having molecules go back and forth like a linear storage ring?
Do ping pong or something.
Yeah, do ping pong. And so you could separate isotopes just based on the mass or shaking them or something.
Yeah. Yeah, so one of the things we did with ammonium molecules also in on top of the fountain, let's say, is to, because we now have programmable control over the shape of the potential, just to wiggle them at different frequencies and see if we excite certain motion, and from that you can get the temperature, or you can do kind of adiabatic cooling tricks. So there's a new things you can do.
If you could, of course, collide them again with something, then you would have nice control over exactly the.
There was the talk last week about using molecular beams, and then
merging
at an angle.
Yeah.
Now, so in that measurement, it's not really not important to translationally cool the molecule. It's the relative motion that was.
Well, of course, you need to make sure that this magnetic guide that was being used to merge them can bend them around the corner, and that is, well, actually quite a bit also of the longitudinal velocity in this case. That's being, they still have to be confined in the guide. They should not spread out. So in that sense, it is important.
Okay.
But it doesn't go into the collision energy in the end.
Okay. So is there any? So there is the you know, the advantage or the kind of physics that you can study by using that technique and by this technique. So one may not be able to study, say, parity variations by using that technique, but you would need to actually cool the molecule to really look temperatures to be able to do that.
Well, you can also study parity violation in a beam, and I know Dave DeMille's in principle also trying to do this. And also like the electron EDM measurement I showed is being done in a beam. So you can do precision measurements in a beam. In a way, you could look at the fountain as a, let's say, more sophisticated version of a beam experiment with a long amount of time. And in a way, usually interaction time really helps for a precision measurement. So in that sense, fast beams colliding, I think, are not the most well-suited for precision measurement. But who knows? If you can translate some kind of collision cross-section or so into a precise determination of something else, perhaps.
So in your strontium fluoride 10 to the fourth molecules, what density will that correspond to in the kind of the volumes you're getting? Is it as high as 10 to the 8 per cubic centimeter or less?
Well, so the rings are 4 millimeter, and we have, so they're about, let's say the trap itself is about one cubic, well, less than a cubic centimeter, I think. But it's a ball of a few millimeter. Then if we apply the laser cooling, the size of the cloud will shrink. And they will come lower in the potential. Of course, you can open up the potential again. They will be larger, so you can have a little bit of control there. What the density would be at that point, actually, I did not calculate, but it shouldn't be so high. Yeah.
So the last stage is to put the whole molecules in an optical trap.
Yeah.
So it's, from my experience working with theories, I understand that they could apply very low, actually, electric fields, like not higher than 5 kilovolt per centimeter. So
okay, on the trap sample.
Yeah. So I just wondered, I saw you doing this.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of experience, but in principle, I think every experimentalist should be able to reach 100 kilovolt per centimeter. But there can be other, of course, restrictions. Perhaps the experiment was originally designed for something else. You want to put some electrodes in, and then because of distances and or the shape restrictions that you have, you cannot reach those high fields. But
it should be specific effort to
You do have to put some kind of effort if you want to reach 100 kilovolt per centimeter. Yeah, but if you put efforts, actually, you can go a factor of 4 or 5 higher or so.
You mentioned on your conclusion slide that you first thought that the effect of interactions would be negligible. But now you doubt this a bit. So, so the question is actually what is in the type of precision that you want to have? And what would then be the estimate of the relationship?
Yeah, so that's why I put that 1 kilohertz down there, because I also realized at some point, of course, you need to be quantitative to proceed, right? So, and what I meant with the first remark is that when we trapped OH, and when while I was in Berlin, that we always thought, well, the density is 10 to the 8 per cubic centimeter, or so it's not high enough for them to see each other. So it doesn't actually make sense to try things like evaporative cooling now. Well, it seems that actually the density is high enough, if we look at the latest results of GE. So that's what I meant. That it could be,
Because on, for instance, the cesium fountain clock, the density is like 10 to the 9th atoms per cubic centimeter.
Yeah.
And that clock is limited by the...
Yeah, but they have something more accurate than the kilohertz. I don't know exactly at what level these different effects show up. Perhaps you know more, Andre.
In cesium clock, right? I mean, I think Heidi and you have contributed quite a lot to understanding of the clock shift, right? And basically, now it is under control, right? So,
I mean, there's still a limiting factor for the decision, right?
No,
prevents you from going more.
Not at the moment, yeah. So. It's like, I mean, it's something technical at the moment. It's like distribution of microwaves in this, in the cavity itself. So it's
No longer. And of course, you can at any point turn it around and say, okay, I might be limited by the fields that surround my trapped molecules. But for example, in the paper of Misha and some others, you could also say that, well, actually, you can use these kind of molecules, very sensitive probes of AC electric fields, for example, or something like that, which is another way of saying it, we are limited by it. So,
when you do laser cooling, do you keep them in a magnetic trap?
Well, they're all the time electrostatically trapped. We've been thinking about doing the laser cooling while they are being decelerated or in the electric trap. I think it gets really complicated because, delta J selection rules are not perfect anymore.
Bring them to the standstill and then do this.
Yeah, so because 1 millisecond is enough based on the radiative lifetime, I think what we do is switch off the fields, do a bit of laser cooling, switch them on again.
Okay, because
milliseconds, so they go 6 meters per second, right? So in a millisecond, they don't go that far.
I was just wondering if you have the level split by an electric or magnetic field, and both of them populated, right? And you try to accumulate population, the collisions would result in, you know, this relaxation.
And actually, another problem is that they would, I think, unless somebody tells me differently, they would also go to electrically high field-seeking states.
Exactly.
So they would not remain in this low field-seeking state that we need them to be in for the whole deceleration to work. So as soon as you shine in a laser, you would pump them to these high field-seeking states, and they would be lost, I think. Even though I don't know all the selection rules in electric fields that well, but I think you would lose.
If you play a field, you break the selection rules.
Yeah, right.
So what's the background gas pressure?
So typically you can get the low 10 minus 9, and then that limits the lifetime by about 1 second. So it's not extreme. It's
so the same better number densities like that. So it will be.
Yeah, so how to translate this 1 times 10 to the minus 9 millibar into a density, I would not be able to do it right now, but it's in a way a trivial calculation to get that number density. It will be mostly the carrier gas, usually, even though after 5 meters with some differential pumping stages, the carrier gas should mostly be gone. Yeah.
So, I mean, there is one alternative to start this deceleration. I think University of Connecticut, they're looking at this proposal with bichromatic forces.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think it's a similar molecule.
Yeah, Edmund Eiler.
So,
that's very interesting.
I'm curious, in respect to the stopping lengths, for example, are his techniques comparable? Or?
I think if you use optical forces and also like that, it should be much smaller than 5 meters. Also, because if you don't have any transverse guiding, after 5 meters, everything will be so far away transversely, you will lose them all. So it could be. It could be a very promising way to do it in some cases. It's just that you cannot base your experiments on techniques that have not yet been developed. Let me say.
At least with atoms, right? At least we know the cycling transitions do exist.
Of course. We know already quite a lot. So I think it's very good that people try diverse approaches to reach the same goal.
Right.
I don't know much actually about that, but I heard that if you go to higher magnetic fields, you have this jitter, right? It's hard to stabilize the strength.
Yeah.
And so it's really possible, according to your estimations, to stabilize this splitting between the levels up to 1 kilohertz?
That is what a the commercial NMR magnets can do. That's a 10^-7 stability.
So we made this proposal to measure fields also, some people said, well, those were theories, but
anyway. Yeah. Are those fields always on, or you have to turn them on?
You have to tune them actually a bit. It depends. So I've been looking into using permanent magnets actually for this.
Then you get trapping forces from them, I guess, because of spatial gradients and stuff.
That's true. Well, it would be a homogeneous magnetic field, so in principle it would just be a shift of all levels, but no, not much a gradient, even though you have to go into this region, right? So it will have some effect. We had something similar when we did experiment with metastable NH, stark deceleration, with a permanent magnetic trap being present. And in the metastable state, NH experienced both the both electric dipole moment and magnetic dipole moment. So you have to adjust timings of the electric field because they also experience the magnetic field. It's not impossible, so that worked.
Any more questions? Thanks, David, again.
Thanks.